Good evening, this is Gary Kavner here on the right side. I'm here today with my friend and colleague Michael Dwyer, now with highly improved audio quality.
We hope.
So, here is the news that we have listened to so that you don't have to subject yourself to it. At least not directly. To start off with, Bonnie Greer, who is not Irish, said something kind of pleasant about Ireland, or at least in line with Irish thinking, and therefore the Irish media has widely filleted her. It is the worst tendency of all Irish people. Anyone who says anything nice about the country, well, you must be a great chap. This is exactly how we ended up sending condolences on the death of Hitler. It's exactly the same thing.
It's nice to be nice.
Yeah, but there's a limit.
Yes, there's a limit to everything.
I think the Holocaust is generally considered it. That was the point at which you could afford to not send the polite note. RTE have put 5 paintings up for auction at Sotheby's. The paintings are valued at roughly €1 million. We will question why exactly RTE has millions of euro worth of paintings lying around the place. We'll then talk about Unplanned, a new film that's been shown in limited theatres around the country. It's been the target of protests and in some cases threats. New research has come back and said that meat, far from killing you, probably isn't killing you, and therefore it is back on the menu. And it did it in the most hilarious way. Michael, do you want to start us off with Bonnie Greer? What did Bonnie Greer say, and why is it important we know who Bonnie Greer is?
Well, I don't imagine it's important at all that we know who Bonnie Greer is, but I will tell the listener just in case.
Bonnie Greer has received national media coverage, Michael. Indeed. If it's not important we know who she is, why is she on newspaper covers?
She was on a television program in the England Question Time, which is obviously a program I'm sure well known to our listener. Bonnie is a cultural and political commentator. I principally know her from many. She used to be on a late night show called the Culture Show or the Arts Show, along with Tom Paul and Jermaine Greer. She's principally a novelist, but she may do some other writing. Anyway, she went on the television and said, in the context of Brexit and some of the commentary you may be aware of in the United Kingdom, and particularly in England, there's a sense that we are not being terribly friendly. We're not helping a chap out in the whole Brexit thing. But she said that the English people know very little about the UK relationship with Ireland. And this has been embedded by the Prime Minister. And that the Irish owe the United Kingdom nothing over Brexit. And she has been inundated with supportive responses online since the show aired on Thursday. Now, it's like you say, Gary, that it is one of the least attractive things about the Irish people, and I'm very fond of the Irish people, some of my best friends are Irish. But this thing, if a foreigner says anything nice about you, or stands up for you, or does something pleasant, this knee-jerk fawning, oh my God, how nice of you to notice us. I mean, I don't know why we do it. I don't know why this is news. It's only news to me in the fact that it is news, which is...
I think it speaks to a fairly deep-seated insecurity about our status as a nation. I mean, I think we should respond to praise the same way the British respond to someone saying they hate the British. A sort of, great, we probably conquered you at some stage, so there you go.
Indeed, and that's... The British can't go across large parts of the world without meeting people who deeply dislike them. And the Germans, almost the only foreign tourists we used to see in the 70s and the 80s were Germans. It was because Germany had finally found a country in Europe that didn't hate them. In fact, they quite liked them and responded in basically like a Jack Russell on its back with his legs in the air, getting its belly tickled when the Germans would say nice things about us. Which they did, because they seemed to like coming here anyway.
And we sent that letter.
And we sent the letter, which was always, you know, it was appreciated. A family, a nation of that kind. It was a traumatic time for Germany, I'm told.
Gosh, that's been like a thank you for trying card.
Yeah, you know. I think that the weird thing, well, not the weird thing, but the fact is, when you look at all the discussions that are happening on social media about this comment, it's so much of it is that the other great Irish flaw. I often quote Richard Miller. He says that the problem in Ireland is when you talk about history, people assume you're talking about politics, and this is a classic example of it. What Cromwell did and what happened at the Battle of the Boyne and the penal laws and the famine, what that has precisely got to do with the negotiations for Brexit kind of escapes me. Now, I agree the Irish people don't owe the UK in this basic sense politically. We don't owe them anything. Because in politics, you don't owe anybody anything. Your job as a government is to go out and get the best deal you can for your country. But I think our point, Gary, has been over the last little while, is the best deal for our country is gained by helping the Brits out.
Mm. I mean, it's gotten to a very strange point in Westminster. The British seem to think that the EU will now actually go for renegotiation on some level. I think the EU, between the Benn Act and the pretty high certainty that there is going to be a general election, has absolutely no incentive to negotiate.
No, it doesn't. And also, I'm saying this with pleasure, because most of the people that I would sort of socialise with or hang around with politically are the kinds of people who think that Brexit is kind of cool, and or from kind of cool to absolutely fantastic. I am not one of those. I have no opinion. Well, I have many opinions, but I don't come down either side of it. The EU doesn't have to have a position, a very positive position towards the British on this. It is the British who are leaving, not the EU. It's the people who the guy who wants to get out of the contract has to do the work. He has to come up with the clauses. He has to come up with the deal. He has to make the proposals. And that mightn't be nice. And maybe you would think that if we were all friends and partners, as we are supposed to be in Europe, then there would be a friendlier tone to this. But, you know,
It actually sort of reminds me of Vietnam.
Which bit?
You get to the end of the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And a large part of the American eventual loss is not any sort of military loss. It's that they just lose the will to actually keep fighting.
Yeah, well, the costs to continue are not politically bearable anymore.
Yeah, the country becomes politically split. Yeah. And so they lose the war largely because of political reasons.
Yeah.
But it shows you the impact that can happen when a country starts to turn on itself and disagree with its own course of action. And I think in Brexit that is abundantly clear. You have people who, if they had all just pulled together on something, probably could have achieved something, pulling in a dozen different directions and spending half their time taking each other down.
You know what? The very first, if not the very first, possibly the second deal or proposal by the much unlamented Prime Minister Theresa May is, if everybody had pulled on that, the chances are that was, it's looking like now, the basis for the best deal that they were going to get. I don't think anybody would be particularly looking to admit to that fact, because there's been a collective decision to decide that Theresa was an absolute disaster and an idiot and a failure in all regards. But I haven't seen anything closer to a deal, and certainly nothing as close to a decent deal for the Brits since that.
I mean, have you heard Labour trying to explain what their Brexit policy is?
Did you?
Labour, if you haven't seen this, is a video online of their spokesperson for this issue, I believe, explaining that their policy is that they will go back to Brussels and they will negotiate a deal. And if they can't get a deal, well, then they won't leave. And the interviewer goes, then why would Europe give you a deal? And he just sort of goes, what do you mean? He goes, well, if you won't leave without a deal, and you'll stay in if there's no deal given, why would Europe not just say, well, you can't have a deal and therefore you can't leave?
Well, I think it may be actually the case.
Cannot answer the question.
It may be the case that at this stage, Brussels may actually give them a deal because they're so sick and tired that they would actually happily see them go.
It's rumoured that Britain reached out to Hungary to ask Hungary if it would veto any extension. Now, I know a couple of people in Hungary, and the general consensus was there is no chance in hell Hungary will veto that deal.
But you're talking about the Labour Party. There's a lovely thing that I came across there, I think it was in The Spectator, which is a report of, I don't know if this is very recent, but it was a meeting in Downing Street between the government and the Labour Party negotiators on Brexit. Anyway, they give them the new policy document, the new proposal. The Labour dudes read it, and the head Labour dude says, no, this isn't even the beginnings of a discussion. And the Conservative guy says, we'll say his name was Philip. He said, Philip, this is Labour policy. We have literally cut and pasted it from your proposal. At which point, there was this knowing laugh at the other side, and a shrugging of shoulders occurred. But I mean,
I do like Jeremy Corbyn.
Mm-hmm.
And the current sort of, this is the worst government we've ever had, it has to be brought down, it's destroying the country. And he put up a tweet actually earlier today, which said, we are preparing for your general election, come and get involved in Labour. And Boris Johnson retweeted it and just said, great, a general election, name the time. And this is a bit of a problem for Labour, because they are currently saying the Tories are destroying the country, and they're refusing to let the Tories leave.
There was a character in stock character in Irish comedy who was the drunk man in the pub, whose line was, when he was trying to avoid the fight but that he himself would provoke, he used to say, hold me back and let me at him. And at the moment, it's Corbyn is very much doing this hold me back and let me at him performance. However, I would observe that we started talking about Miss Greer, we are now talking about Brexit again, and I suspect that unless we contain ourselves, we might spend the rest of the time talking about Brexit. And there will be much more time to talk about it in the future. I don't think that this is going to be a disappearing story.
No, particularly if it goes the way it's... Ah, we'll talk about that later. So, RTE put 5 paintings up for auction in a bid to boost funds. They're going directly to Sotheby's, which I imagine is going to annoy some of the Irish auction houses.
Yeah, there's one... I can't remember. It's not Phillips, is it something? There's one kind of high-end big art dealer. But there are a number of auctioneers here anyway. Why they've gone directly to Sotheby's rather than to give the commission to the local lads is something that I think they should tell us. Or they will say, well, it was a 10, you know, they want to get the best deal available for the people of Ireland. But, you know, the people of Ireland in Dalkey have to eat too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really care about this in that I don't really care about RTE's continued existence. But I will say this, why does RTE have, you know, it just goes, oh, we you know, we're a little shy of cash. Let's sell 1 million in art.
Well, the first thing is, I'm sure when they, I say I'm sure, I am speaking from complete ignorance, so this may be completely untrue. However, I imagine, we'll put it that way, I imagine that when this art was bought, it didn't cost them 1 million.
Here's the thing, I know of the 5 pieces that are on sale.
Yeah.
2 were specifically commissioned by RTE. One in 2000.
2000, that recently?
Yeah, that would still be in the pissing money against the wall phase of RTE's life.
I think they piss money pretty...
Sorry, let me rephrase that. Pissing money against the wall while making a loss.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's a distinction. Who else? Do you have the names of the artists?
I do. So, the names of the artists, the 2 that were commissioned by Louis Le Bourquois.
Louis Le Bourquois, yeah.
Bourquois.
Le Bourquois, yeah.
William Scott.
Yeah.
Which is just titled Abstract Painting. Tony O'Malley.
Yeah.
And George Campbell.
The Louis Le Bourquois, I'd like. I mean, if anybody wants to buy it, I give it to Scott. Scott, he was better known as an architect for building ugly buildings around Dublin. But and the Valley, no, I'll go for the. I'll take the Le Bourquois, Ryan, and I'll go home.
This is just a general point I have about RTE.
They have to put something on the walls, Gary. They have to something pretty, something Irish. So people are visiting. Ooh,
do you know
nice.
What you could put on the wall, Michael?
What?
A wood print of the name RTE.
Well, you know what I'd like to put on the wall is.
Do you know what?
This
we,
is where
we
RTE used to be.
That's true. But what we don't. I mean, this is the thing. Not all of RTE's money comes from the public purse because they also advertise, which is grotesquely unfair.
Well, I think the advertisers get most of their money from the public as well. I mean, it's the same public. It's just gathered in a different way. But it's, yes, I know what you mean, sorry. Coercively gathered.
RTE is a state entity that spends public funds.
Yes.
As part of that, it should be dedicated to ensuring that there is value for money in the usage of those funds.
Yes.
Because everything they spend is taken from someone's paycheck.
Yes.
And anything taken from your paycheck materially decreases the quality of life that you and your family have.
Yes.
So on that basis, why the fuck did I have 1 million euro in art?
It doesn't seem to be part of their core competence.
And here's another question. This is just 5 paintings that they randomly decided to sell.
Mm-hmm.
How much more art do they have? And would you say, I wouldn't say this is, you know, the top level of art in RTE. I wouldn't say any of these were hanging up in the chief executive's office.
The DG. I imagine the DG might have maybe a couple of... couple of Yeats, maybe a Keating, Paul Henry. Oh, I do like a Paul Henry.
These are people who every year ask for more and more money, and then we find they've just got millions of euro worth of art around the place.
Hanging around the gaff.
Yeah, I mean, these are people losing 20 million a year. Surely at some point someone would say, well, cut your costs and sell the art.
Gary, not to be pedantic, but if you remember, we talked about salaries in RTE previously. And we discovered that at one stage before he left RTE, Pat Kenny was earning around 900,000 a year before it was cut back to 700 and something thousand a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a media market the size of Manchester, could people who are serious or rational about money and commercial value and giving value for money, shall we say, to the investor, us, would pay somebody 900,000 a year to do what Pat Kenny did?
Maybe not to do what Pat Kenny did, but there are people in television and in media who are worth that.
Not in media markets the size of Manchester, there aren't. There are in London. There are people who are on. Graham Norton, I'm sure, is worth that. Because Graham Norton...
I say Graham Norton is worth a great deal more than that.
He's worth a great deal more than that, but he's not actually getting a hugely amount more than that, actually. Because he's on the BBC and they publish the figures. He's, I'm sure, doing very nicely, and God bless him. But my point is that he's in a media market of 60-odd million people. And the show is syndicated and sold around the world and is on, if not Dave, it's on, God knows, it's on some kind of channels or in your hotel in Bilbao.
And, I mean, there is an important point to make here. Graham Norton is probably one of the finest interviewers in the world. It's a very particular style. It's not a style that would work on many things, but in the area in which he interviews people, he is absolutely fantastic.
He's flawless. And now, whether you like it or you don't like it, it's not point. The point, his capacity in an era where increasingly talk shows find it difficult to get a series of high quality, big star guests, he has them queuing up because they love him. They love his show. They love the way they feel on the show. All the feedback sounds the same. And you see it from the lineup and the kind of guests that he has. He gets them all and he gets them again and again. Anyway, my point, you look at what the guys from Top Gear were earning and the amount of money. That was the biggest television show in the world, as Jeremy might have said. The salaries, we will never know, sadly. But I will put it to you, Gary, that if we were operating in a simple free market, which was where salaries were not distorted by the subsidy and subvention of a license fee, then what we see people being paid would be literally a fraction. That the number of people who are earning much more than 100 or 150,000 a year would be very small indeed. Because they simply would not be able to commercially justify that kind of money.
Well, I mean, also, for people who say, well, you know, we need to pay these things to keep these people. No one has yet been able to convince me that keeping these people is in any way a good thing. Get rid of them. Bring in some younger people who'll work for less. Some of them will succeed.
Or older people who'll work for less.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm happy to have George Hook back. He entertained me on my radio in a way that, frankly, God, listening to news talk these days is just... I listen to it for the sport. I used to listen to sport talk because it was the last refuge where you could go where you weren't being battered by a contemporary political culture.
You can't listen to sport on news talk.
No.
Particularly, was it off the ball?
Oh, God. It's so fucking woke now. It's just, constantly, just drip. It's so sad. There is no part of civil society or civil discourse now which is not occupied by discourse.
Well, I mean, I don't think we can complain too much about that, Michael, given that we are effectively a political and cultural podcast which talks about it incessantly.
Yeah, we don't talk about sport.
No, I think it's fair to leave sport in its own place.
That's my point. We recognise, as good conservatives, good Michael, good Oakeshottians, that there are parts of your life you don't want to have dedicated to politics, that everything in life does not or should not be political. There have to be spaces left in your life and in our shared lives as citizens and as compatriots where we can go and we can coexist apolitically, Because otherwise, how are we going to talk to each other?
I mean, we probably won't.
We probably won't, is right, and I'm not sure that's...
But then, you know, Michael, we could have a jolly good civil war, and that'll sort that out for about 200 years.
Well, it's either that or it's bowling alone.
Or as Camus said, absolute freedom is merely the prevailing of absolute strength.
Yes. Well done, Camus. Anyway.
So, there have been protests outside a new movie, which has just come out. It's playing in limited screens across Ireland.
Yes.
A movie is called Unplanned. It is a... it's... Whether or not it's a true story, I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know how much liberty it takes with...
It's supposed to be the Abby Johnson story, isn't it?
Yeah, so Abby Johnson, for those who don't know, is meant to be a woman who worked in Planned Parenthood, was very pro-choice... helped in a couple of abortions and then became pro-life and from there an anti-abortion activist. And the story is basically on her life and why she decided to leave Planned Parenthood and how she became pro-life. And it's that sort of film. However, this has led to a series of protests about the film across the country from everyone from various pro-choice groups around the country. The remnants of Repeal the Eighth, Together for Yes, and some of the anti-racist groups.
Yes.
Which I find profoundly weird. So whether or not you care for this sort of film, I think, is beside the point. It's all a little bit Father Ted.
It really is. It's very with this kind of thing. Do you see the photographs?
I did. There's a grey photograph, I think, from Galway, and it's very bright out, and it's people out front with their signs. And the detail that really got to me is the... And you get unlucky with this, because with a cinema, it's all glass-fronted.
Yeah.
And they put up the billboards for the next movies that are up. And the next... Whatever the next movie is, there's just this giant, amorphous, purple, fetus-like thing smiling behind them.
Ah.
And it just doesn't... It's not a serious look.
You were saying the anti-racist was our friend and comrade Joe Lochnane, on the warpath.
Yeah, so Joe Lognan, if you haven't seen the earlier coverage we did of him or the article I wrote about him, is the chairman of the Galway Anti-Racism Network. When we looked into Mr. Lognan, it turned out that he had sent racial abuse to people. He had told them to kill themselves. We found video of him screaming down a speaker at an event he didn't like. I found out he had been charged with 2 counts of assault against 2 Gardaí. He worked previously with Cage, which is a group in the UK.
Had a colourful life.
He's got the kind of life where if you wanted someone to speak against racism, you would probably pick someone who hadn't worked with a group which was described, I believe, by Amnesty International's and one of their directors as being the most high-profile organisation dedicated to the promotion of the Taliban.
Okay. Are we saying that... Oh, no, hold on now. I don't want to be... Are you suggesting that the Taliban is racist? Because I've never said anybody that... The Taliban has always seemed to me to attract a wide diversity of cultures, and ethnicities. Which is one of the things I've often admired about the Taliban. Its ability to engage in that kind of diversity. And yet maintain that kind of focused attention to its primary purpose.
I mean, Michael, no one is disagreeing with you that the Taliban is a detail and objective oriented organization.
And
however,
diversity, with strong commitment to diversity.
But their representatives have spoken in favor of Sharia law. They have refused to condemn death by stoning for adultery, female genital mutilation. There's a really weird video of their spokesperson responding to the question, would he refute the idea that Jews are descended from apes and donkeys, I think, by saying, well, I'm not a theologian, which is a fantastic answer, at least. And, you get the idea. Homosexuality is evil, the whole kind of 9 years. And he worked for them for a period.
I would love to see that guy's Intercert biology paper. Because if he thinks that theology, descending from apes and monkeys or pig is a theological thing.
I mean, you studied to be a priest, did it come up? Not in the work of Aquinas.
No, or... not in the philosophy section. Now it may have come up in the secret closed door cabal meetings that I didn't get into.
The anti-Jew philosophy wing of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, that's where all the Jesuits and the Freemasons get together. So maybe, Gary, I didn't get into that.
So Mr. Loughnane had this to say about the film.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Not content with inciting racial hatred in this country, the forced birthers are now trying to fill our cinemas with their anti-woman trash. It's as simple as this. That film will not be shown in that cinema tonight." Speaking about the his local cinema. The film was subsequently shown in his local cinema that night, so...
The first time that I heard that statement, I have to say, and I want to say it again, my initial reaction, very pure and simple, was the arrogance of the bollocks. That will not be shown. Now, dear listener, listen and heed those words. That will not be shown. Joe knows better. Joe gets to decide what will be on in the cinema and what won't. And if Joe gets to decide what's on in the cinema and what isn't, he gets to decide what's on the TV and on the radio and in the bookshops and in the newspapers, because there ain't no difference, folks. But that is Joe's fundamental belief. So don't be surprised when Joe and people like Joe get into power and behave like that. Don't come back crying to us and saying, "Oh, you never told us." We're telling you now.
I mean, he also failed in that call. I'm told, I've asked a couple of cinemas, that ticket sales are actually quite strong. Protesting against a film that the general public has never heard of this film.
Absolutely.
It's not going to have an advertising budget. So this whole thing, I can see why it happens, because for people like Joe and for those organizations, it gives them something to do. It makes them feel like they're doing something. The problem is, it's a symbiotic relationship with the thing they're trying to stop. People need to be aware of the thing they're trying to stop for it to be any use to them, so they therefore must promote. It's like Antifa and the alt-right in America.
Yes, they need...
Antifa in order to crush...
They need each other.
They need an opponent,
yeah.
Or else they're just nutters who go around beating people with bicycle locks.
I don't know if we need to make the qualification. They could be that as well. But the point you made earlier, actually, just there, is, I think, actually very true and very important. That for these groups, the important thing is that they must be doing something. They have to. There always has to be an activity. There always has to be something to protest, something to attack, something to boycott, something to stone. Because otherwise,
it's a standard truth of politics.
Yeah.
I mean, you see it in any political party. People need to do things. If they're not doing things, the organization starts to splinter.
Yeah.
And it becomes very difficult. It's as they say, the most difficult thing is to start something. So once you start it, you never want it to stop, because then you need to start it again.
Joe, of course, is a strong supporter of the introduction of hate speech laws.
Yes, he is. He is very much a strong supporter of hate speech laws. Hate speech as defined by Joe.
Yes. But isn't that the tricky thing? Isn't that always the tricky thing? Can I just briefly, before we go on to our next point, there's something I want to just have a quick observation about. It's one of those, what state are we in the country? I don't know where you were last night or the night before when the great Lorenzo did or did not hit, depending on what part of the country you were in. Now, the social media was absolutely full of people giving out about the fact that the weather wasn't bad enough, because either the newspapers or somebody on the radio or somebody on the telly had said, oh my God, it's going to be awful. I kept an eye on Met Aaron, and Met Aaron never said anything over the top. It said there was yellow, it was going to be windy, it might get very windy, but come back later, we'll know better. Then it was never a big deal. It was never massively hysterical. And I just think it's bizarre, in a country which, frankly, we get enough wind and enough rain, for people to go onto Facebook in their floods of thousands to complain we didn't get enough rain and we didn't get enough wind. And there were no cows taken off from the plains of Meath and landed in the city of Dublin by hurricanes or tornadoes.
How does it feel to have reached a point in your life in which where you want to talk about is not complaining about the weather, but complaining about other people complaining about the weather?
I'm not complaining. I just think it's hilarious. Genuinely. I was laughing at them today. We have reached the point in this country where, when by the way, in the last week, it's not that we haven't had enough rain I mean, well, at least where I am, we've had plenty. They're going, we didn't rain enough. How disappointing. You know, it's just, it's, have we become so infected? Is it the need? We have to have something desperately to complain about. If we don't complain, ergo sum, is that it? Our existence is proved by the complaints that we have. I don't know. But I thought it was one of the great comic sights of Ireland was all the people complaining that it hadn't rained enough in a windstorm in October. Anyway.
We have finally got, we have now got an incredibly large meta-analysis of the research into meat. And for those of you who don't know, a meta-analysis is a research paper or technique where instead of researching the thing yourself and conducting an experiment, you go through already published papers and you analyze those papers. So you can be looking for commonalities, you can be looking to see how well they stack up, you can be looking for flaws in the data, you can do a load of stuff with a meta-analysis. So a meta-analysis on red meat was just published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is considered to be one of the most prestigious journals in the world, looking at research into red meat and whether or not it was a carcinogen and whether or not it was bad for you. And that paper basically tore pieces out of most of the research on the field and said it proved nothing. And the paper basically said that there is no real proof that red meat is, as we've been told for decades at this point, actually bad for you. It may be bad for you. They didn't come out and say it's not bad for you. What they said was there's no scientific evidence of any great worth. Most of the studies that said it was are fundamentally flawed. And the reaction to the publication of that meta-analysis has been incredible. I have seen scientists saying the study should not have been published, that it was it would do harm to the field of science itself.
Yeah.
Because it dared to go, that thing we've been telling people for decades, never really any proof behind it. This was all terribly done. And not just two bit scientists. I saw quotes from Harvard scientists who were arguing this should have never been released, not because of any methodological flaws with it, but just because they don't like its results and they don't like the fact it said other papers were not well put together. And I mean, if you want to talk about someone being anti-science, a person who says you should not publish solid results because it could make someone else look bad, or because the field has said it's another way for years, you're pretty anti-science in the idea that you were against the idea of the scientific method.
I think one of the oddities about the complaints is that the fact that these complaints are being made and then the number is odd. I was trying to think, why such negativity, man? Why such bad vibes?
I was also amazed by...
And the only thing I can come up with is that we have been experiencing for the last number of years a fairly relentless theme from a lot of people, where you had both the health on one side and the Greens on the other, saying we have to reduce the number of cattle in the world, and not just cattle, but all kinds of farm animals. We have to reduce the amount of meat we take in. We have to be moving towards, if not actually vegetarian diets, but principally vegetarian diets. And all of the scientific research on the health side of it up to now had seemed to be pushing in that direction. And we know that people are far more likely to change their behaviour based on a perception of a threat to their personal health and longevity rather than a theoretical impact it's going to have on the planet. So if you're now saying to people, you know what, the whole thing about, you know, the stomach cancer and the colon cancer and the high blood pressure and the cholesterol and all that, don't worry about it. I mean, one of the issues also here is the question of communication, I think, and the worry about messages. I remember I used working with a group of cardiologists. Now, if what they told me was a lie, then I was told a lie. But I remember we were talking about cholesterol and heart attacks and things. And they said to me, actually, the stuff about diet and cholesterol is mostly untrue. So by what do you mean untrue? He said, well, the single biggest factor, it seems now, regarding the levels of bad cholesterol in your diet would be your genetic predisposition to high cholesterol. Your second highest factor in having high cholesterol level is in badly managed stress, or how you do or you don't manage your stress levels. The third factor was smoking. Smoking elevated cholesterol. And the fourth factor was diet. And they said it's somewhere between 10 and 20% of people we can actively control their cholesterol by change. He said there are cases where you put people on a very low cholesterol diet and their cholesterol goes up because they're so fucking stressed out by the diet they're on that it actually drives their cholesterol to a higher level. And they said, it's much easier just give them a statin. And I said, but why don't you tell people? He said, why? Because the basic message is actually still the same. You shouldn't consume more calories than you should. That high fat diet is bad for you. It's not bad for you necessarily in the same way because of cholesterol, but high fat diets will make you fat. And being fat is very, very bad for you. Speaking, I say this as a fat person. So, you know, people get confused with messages. So it's not doing any harm. So maybe there's a sense that people think that the plain people are going to be confused by this. And in fact, we are told by a lady in The Independent who said, who was it? What was her? I've lost the lady in The Independent. Avian Bannon, a consultant dietitian working at the Dublin Nutrition Centre. I can never remember. Dietitians and dietologists. One of them is actually a real thing, and one of them is a makey-uppy thing. Anyway, headlines like this make it hard for consumers to know what to do. You find that a research study like this comes out and is controversial because it contradicts something we thought we knew, so it makes headlines. But the reality is that when health bodies make official recommendations, they do so based off the results of one study, but of hundreds and hundreds of studies.
That is often incorrect.
That is, in fact, often incorrect. And one of the,
as we are seeing now, actually, with vaping.
If you look at, for example, what the World Health Organization, and that's one that is really poor on this, but because it's a UN organization, which is beyond me, why attaching something to the United Nations, one of the most useless, corrupt, rotten, mendacious, stinking, putrefying things in the face of the planet should make it be taken seriously, I do not know. But it is. When WHO makes a statement, it's regarded as being definitive.
Actually, the point there on dietitians is an important one. The people who conducted this research were not nutrition researchers for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
They were methodologists,
uh-huh,
which are scientists who specialise in statistical analysis and study of the methodology of research.
Yes.
And they basically appear to have thought, this is just sloppy. The field is sloppy.
Yeah.
So we'll have a bit of a look at it and just cut through it. And we've been seeing similar things like this in, particularly in psychology the last while, the replication crisis, where many of the most highly cited psychological research of all time, mm-hmm, when people have tried to replicate it, turned out you can't redo the experiments, which would indicate that the results are not true.
Oh, that's in anthropology, sociology, psychology, the number of non-replicable experiments that manage still to get published in peer-reviewed journals is huge.
Well, I mean, it's fair that they're published initially, because at that point you need to publish them before anyone can replicate them.
Yep, but there should be a mechanism to replicate.
Yeah, whereas there have been situations where a paper will be published in, let's say, Nature, and then someone will try and replicate it, and will go, this can't be replicated. They will submit the fact it can't be replicated to Nature, and then they'll get a response saying, well, it's not novel and new work, so we're not going to publish it.
Hmm.
When surely one could argue that, well, you published results that now appear to be false, therefore you have a duty to publish an attempt to replicate if one is offered and is of a decent quality.
It seems to me, not to sound too much like one's granny, that if you just stick to the principle of don't eat too much of anything and eat lots of different things, you're probably on a pretty decent bet. I'm just looking here at a page from The Independent, which is, you know, those stories that pop up beside whatever story you're looking at online. And beside it, in the life section, we have nutritionist to the Royals says secret to weight loss is balance of blood sugar. right? Do you know what the headline on the story directly underneath it?
Go on.
Caveman diet of fasting followed by feasting is secret to losing weight. And then underneath it, again, we have super rich diets. But it is something with low in sugar, but high in these superfoods is the secret to losing weight.
Hey, look, I will be fair to nutrition researchers here. It is a very difficult field to actually research in, because it's very difficult to separate the impacts of diet and within diet one particular thing. It's incredibly difficult to get people to just stick to a bloody change in diet.
Incredibly hard.
I mean, and to be fair, what we've seen over the last decade, 15 years, is that the quality of research in nearly every major social science is incredibly poor. And peer review does not seem to be doing anything to drive up the quality. It appears to have become a form of checkbox exercise. Do you know the most damning thing about the psychology replication issue? The people who are doing it, what they do, well, there's people who are doing it independently and there's groups that are doing it. But something that's started to happen is they offer people, they go to people who are sort of seasoned gamblers.
Right.
Beforehand, and they give them the study and they ask them to bet if it will replicate or not.
Okay.
And the chance of gamblers being able to decide, I think it's 70 or 80% accuracy.
Wow. What does that say?
But here's the thing.
What does that tell us?
Every one of those studies will have gone through peer review and will have had potentially dozens of eyes on it, depending on the size of, maybe more depending on the study.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, five random gamblers have a far above chance, the rate you would receive with chance, which would presumably be 50-50 over the long run, because it turns out that most of these studies have certain commonalities, because they tend to make very large claims, they tend to be novel claims that go against human intuition,
right?
And they tend to have, quite a lot of them, political angles,
yes,
or can be put in political angles. That reminds me of the great study published a few years ago, which studied the psychological makeup of conservatives and liberals.
Oh, yes.
And it wasn't very kind to conservatives.
Yes.
And then it turned out that they had accidentally reversed a lot of the coding. So what they had said was true for conservatives was actually true for liberals.
Yeah.
And they refused to correct it until they were told that the researcher who had been talking to them about it was going to publish it anyway.
Yes.
That their work was wrong. And then it was just quietly corrected.
That was joyous. That was joyous.
That was a great one, because I remember hearing it, that they'd made a mistake, and I was like, oh, what mistake? Like, oh, we reversed the coding. Which is to say, if you had it said that liberals are A, conservatives are B, B would generally be bad. But then it turned out they had reversed that accidentally because they were just sloppy.
Because they're just shite at their job.
But that's true. So, there is a question here about the value of peer review.
Yeah,
seem to be doing anything for the social sciences.
That's been a subject for the last couple of years. I know we've had, the SOTCO?
The Sokol hoax?
Yeah, Sokol hoax, and then other hoax like it. It's becoming harder and harder to take a hell of it. Also, it's a simple fact. The vast majority of work that is published is read once, if ever, and is never cited and never referred to or quoted.
No, I mean, the vast majority of scientific research, published scientific research, is garbage. I mean, I read a lot of papers just because of what I do in various fields, because when you work in different areas, you kind of get used to just picking at things and picking up areas. The vast majority of stuff I see is garbage. I mean, the sample size is either really low, or you'll get to what I will generally do now is, if it's something novel, I'll just immediately go to the methodology section.
You know, you understand the technicalities of the methodology far better than I do, but even somebody like myself, when you just look at the bare bones of the thing, very often you can just say, I'm sorry, this is a nonsense. I remember when, in the good old days, when the referendum on before us was gay marriage, going through a pile of the studies on families and family outcomes and whatever, there were something like 50 different studies had been done in published in journals on the subject of children being raised by same-sex parents, and then comparing them, contrasting them with the outcomes with different kinds of other different kinds of families. And they were supposedly bar one and then two. There was the Regenerist paper and then there was an Australian paper, which were questioned the outcomes. One of the papers, I'm not making this up, published in a peer review and quoted and included as one of the papers which was informing people at, say, for example, the Citizens' Assembly or the Constitutional Convention or whatever it was called at Menhide, and which was and given as an example to members of the Oireachtas of Good Science, was a sample size of 5 lesbians in Southern California.
You, a lot of this research you'll look at, and you'll see a couple of common things. A sample size of about 10. Conducted on students in a university setting. Those are kind of big, immediate sort of, if you see something and it has a sample size of 10, just, you can fairly freely discount it. Not to say it's wrong, but it certainly doesn't prove anything.
And no comparator group very often as well. So that you actually have no sense when they make a claim saying, which demonstrates that the outcomes for children are the same as they would be in X or Y. But then you go and you see that actually they haven't measured X or Y.
Or you can find one where a theory will be put forward that will directly contradict with a much more proven theory. And the one I think my personal favourite is in criminology, and it's research on do three-strike rules work. Oh, yeah. And I'm not saying three-strike rules are a good idea, by the way. I think there are better uses for your money, and there have actually been some interesting pieces done on that. But you will look, you read a lot of criminology research on three-strikes, and you notice a couple of things. You have authors openly making ideological arguments against it.
Yeah.
I've read papers in which authors have openly talked about how emotional the whole thing makes them, which is a weird trend towards self-inserting in research I really don't like. But one thing that I've always found interesting is it's a fairly supported idea in criminology that the vast majority of crimes are committed by a relatively small percentage of the population.
Yes.
And that they will habitually commit crimes.
Mm-hmm.
No one has ever been able to explain to me how that can be true, and how three-strike rules don't work.
Well, yeah, but...
Now, I'm not saying that three-strike rules are the best usage of them, but I have openly seen people say they have no impact at all.
Yeah,
I would say they obviously have impact. Whether or not that impact is more or less than, let's say, a well-established rehabilitation program with proper support after release is an entirely different effect. But these are people saying openly, this has no effect at all.
Yeah,
and I think the likelihood of that is basically zero.
The problem I think that a lot of people have is actually in those cases or similar cases is to achieve a noticeable improvement, you actually you have to engage in a practice which they just find fundamentally distasteful. One of the things, I used to be of the opinion that, you know, a lot of the, you know, longer sentences, the short, sharp stop, all that stuff, the good, you know, good old-fashioned conservative penology didn't work. It was pointless. Until I looked at the figures that were done over the 80s and the 90s in certain parts of the States. And it seemed to be that there was a fairly unsophisticated, brutal fact that if you basically locked up enough of men aged, say, between, say, 16 and 35, say if you're talking about burglary, the vast majority of burglaries that take place, they're almost all men, and they take place, they burglarize between the ages of 18 and 35. After the age of 35, for whatever reasons, the number of people, men who persist in that behavior just tails off massively. So if you get enough of the part of that population which is engaged in that activity, and you simply would take them out of society for long enough, you have an effect on crime. I mean, it's a fairly crude and brutal way of doing it, and it's a very expensive way of doing it. And it seems at times, from a, say, a justice point of view, a disproportionate way of doing things. Because you get somebody, you put them in, you say, okay, I'm going to put you in prison for 15 years for doing what doesn't feel like a 15-year crime. But I know that if I do that, that you're not going to be outside. You'll be committing crime in prison, but you won't be committing a crime outside prison. And by the time you get out, your propensity to continue committing that kind of crime will have massively decreased. Because the studies would have shown that you just don't... It's a young man's game.
Yeah, you can't take a massive percentage of criminals and lock them away for years and have no impact on the crime rate. You just can't.
No.
Unless all the other research is wrong, and in fact most crimes are one-offs by people who don't commit other crimes, which is unlikely to be true. But there just seems to be this constant trend that lots of people seem to believe that explanation is justification. And if you explain something and you accept that, okay, well, it does have this effect.
Yeah.
And that effect is generally considered positive.
Yeah.
And you then go, but there are better ways to do this. You have justified the thing that you said, you know, worked to a degree.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. You can never justify certain things.
Anyway, I think it is time to say goodbye and wish all of our listeners a very lovely Sunday to spend disporting themselves and recreating themselves as they please. We will be back hot and ready on Monday. Until then, it's goodbye from me.
And it will be goodbye from me. We will see you all on Monday and then Wednesday, where I'm sure we will be talking about the budget. I'm sure you can hardly wait.
Oh, God, be still my beating heart.